Hi, this is John DeLancey, and you are listening to the GeekCast Radio Network.
Hello, and welcome to episode 227 of the Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me is the Comic Concierge. Hello, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. We are back at it. A tiny break with some scheduling issues I had, but we're back at our normal situation here, making our way through the Cary Grant filmography. We have covered 5 of his films, not counting the 4 from the Hitchcock series. So that's 9 total. This is our 10th, I believe. So we are talking about the 1944 film None But the Lonely Heart. This is some connection to Penny Serenade, as it's his only other film that he received an Oscar nomination for. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of None But the Lonely Heart, Dan, I believe you came into this one, as I did, completely blind, correct?
I did, yeah. I knew nothing about it. I didn't know the plot. I never watched it before. I don't even think I've seen much discussion regarding it. Like, the name, like, is the only thing I think I've heard before. But mostly because I think also it's the book, too. But yeah, I was unaware of anything going into this one.
And a song, which is, I think, where the name came from as well. So So I'm guessing that the listeners may also know not a lot about None But the Lonely Heart. So let's give them a chance to figure out what this film is all about while you give us the facts about None But the Lonely Heart. And then we'll come back with our thoughts right after this.
I thought about doing this in a British accent, but I figured I'd save everyone the secondhand embarrassment. None But the Lonely Heart, released in 1944, was directed by Clifford Otis, starring Cary Grant, Ethel Barrymore, Barry Fitzgerald, June Dupres, and Jane Wyatt, and is adapted from the Richard Llewellyn novel. The film follows Ernie Mott, a restless and aimless young man of a working-class family in London between the World Wars. Ernie drifts through life without clear direction or ambition, preferring to live by his charm and wits rather than hard work. When he returns home, he discovers that his widowed mother is gravely ill, but still running her small secondhand shop. As he reconnects with her, Ernie struggles between longing for independence and guilt over neglecting her. To help pay bills, Ernie reluctantly becomes involved with a shady group of criminals, but his conscience and love for his mother pull him in another direction. Ultimately, the story becomes a moving portrait of a man seeking meaning, belonging, and redemption amid hardship and moral choices. The film was well-received at the time, receiving a few Oscar nominations, including writing, music, and 2 acting awards for Cary Grant and Ethel Barrymore, who won for Best Supporting Oscar. The title None But the Lonely Heart comes from a romantic song by Chayefsky, which reflects Ernie's inner melancholy and search for connection. This was one of the few films directed by Clifford Otis, a renowned American playwright. Richard Llewellyn's original novel was far longer and more episodic, following Ernie over many years. Clifford Otis condensed it into a more focused, emotional story about his relationship with his mother. Though it wasn't a huge box office hit, None But the Lonely Heart gained respect over time for its emotional honesty and social conscience, even receiving admiration from Martin Scorsese for its tone and performances. But how well does it hold up all these years later? And does it compare to Cary Grant's other Oscar-nominated performance? Back to Kevin and myself to discuss.
All right, thanks, Dan, for all the facts about None But the Lonely Heart. So now that you've had a chance to watch this one, what was your initial reaction from his second Academy Award-nominated role?
So watching this was interesting because I was going through it, and like everything, you know, on paper made kind of sense. I thought the performances were fine, minus the, like, not being able to understand or place any of the accents of anyone, including Cary Grant. It was just like, is he doing an accent? Is he doing his normal voice? I can't tell. But like the scripting, the plotting, it all kind of made sense for the most part. And like everything here, like, I just, it's not bad, but just something feels off. I couldn't place it. I'm just like, something about this just seems odd. It seems strange. It just doesn't seem to be working like right for some reason. And, you know, go through the, and I felt like that the entire way. Just in the sense of like looking how well everything was executed, that was fine. I didn't find it nearly as, you know, dramatic as Penny Serenade or anything like that. It also had very little comedy, but it was just something about it just, you know, I feel like this should be better than it is. Like, why isn't it working? Everything is somewhat there. And then I go in, learn about the movie itself, and then find out that Cary Grant's character is meant to be a teenager. And everything kind of starts making much more sense. Because, it does feel off, because all these scenes that you have, this is supposed to be a coming-of-age story, and he's middle-aged. So the drama doesn't really fit as well when he has this dynamic with his mom, which I thought was fine, but it doesn't hit the right way, because it's like meant to be this kid who is, you know, getting into that adolescence, like that separation from finally leaving home. And this more feels like just like a guy who's not, should be old enough to be on his own by now. And like all these different scenes where it's meant to be this person kind of overcoming the doldrums of the society trying to bring him down, like, you know, this person is well above his 8 years, but instead it's just this odd thing where this middle-aged man is just kind of just aloft, and not really, it just didn't fit. And I think that was my ultimate issue with it. It's just, it didn't fit in the sense of the character, the casting. Like, casting is one of the most important things, and when you don't have that right, it can really bring down a film. And for me, despite the performances being fine, I like a lot of the messaging within the film. And I can only imagine, like, reading the book, it probably reads a lot better. But it just, Cary Grant, I felt just, his performance was okay, minus the accent, but it just felt off the entire time for me.
I think this was a situation where, from what I can gather from some slight research on some of the background from the film, it feels like Cary Grant saw a connection in the material to his own life, and really wanted to, because he connected with the story or the character or whatever, like, really wanted to be a part of it, even though, like, he didn't come to the realization that he wasn't the right person to play that role anymore. Like, I believe he bought the film rights to this to ensure that he was cast as the main role.
Yeah.
And I believe there's pictures at one point in, like, one of the rooms or something that's literally his actual dad or somebody in his family. Like, he has a deep connection somehow to the content, and I felt like that made him motivated to be a part of it to a point where he almost lost sight of the fact that he's not that person anymore, or couldn't pull that off as well as he maybe thought he could. And I think there was something with one of the writers or somebody that was doing it that was trying to, I don't know if it was who was trying to adapt this to the screen or how it was working, but somebody was like basically saying that once he realized that Cary Grant was going to be involved and there was no way around that he had to like try to rewrite some aspects of it because it's supposed to be a teenager and he's 40. And it just doesn't seem to match up. So I think that is like alluding to a lot of the things that you're talking about. I feel like also this may suffer slightly because it's a first-time director. Mm. On top of that, so Clifford Odets is the director, but also the writer. But I just feel like this being his first film, and he only directs 2 films, I believe, in his life. Like, he's more known for his Broadway, you know, play stage things, and he did a little bit more writing, but he only is a film director that I can see twice, once for this film and then once 15 years later for one other film. So I think that also plays into a part of maybe somebody that was dealing with a medium that he also wasn't as familiar with, maybe being able to be persuaded by, you know, Cary Grant to do things. I don't know what the situation was, but I feel like in better hands, maybe this would have worked. Or I could also see like a remake of this film working better than the original if it was with a younger actor that we could clearly see this as a coming of age film with a better director that could really go through some of the stuff that they're dealing with. Because I think there is something there. Like, granted, it's not going to be like the most funny or entertaining film, but I do think like when we're talking about this time in history with the world wars and things like that and the depression and all of those other things that had gone on in the lives of these folks, like, I think there is some emotional undertones that could be tapped into and could be explored in an entertaining way. I just think this one missed for a couple different reasons with getting there.
Yeah. Like, for example, you know, losing, obviously losing a parent at any age is impactful, but losing a parent at, like, when you're a teenager compared to when you're 40, it's a very different experience. So it just feels like the way they approached it was, this is the guy that should at least have some understanding of who he is as a person. And I guess we all kind of still develop no matter what our age is, but he shouldn't be so influenced by, like, the neighborhood, like, gangster or whatever, like, always falling into the wrong gang. At this point in time, like you're when you're that old, it seems like a weird choice to, like, you know, to even, like, have a gang to fall into, because, like, you got things to do. And, like, you mentioned with the... Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
And you mentioned with the age, too, considering, you know, this is in the brink of World War II, you know, or, like, after the Great War, and, like, I think that also loses its impact, too, because if you have that teenager who, you know, this event that is on its way as well, you know, the war in Europe, and, like, how that can impact his life, it's very different for, like, a four-year-old. You have, like, that type of, you know, foreshadowing, that type of impact is minimal with this. So, mm-hmm. I know they said they rewrote the script, and I can't compare it to the book because I never read it, but it felt like they needed more, even, like, the relationships there, too. Like, he's, like, stuck between two women, and I think as a teenager, you can understand it more. Here, he just feels like a bad guy that's, like, just taking advantage of people.
Yeah, so. This makes that relationships would play so much better if it was easy to connect the dots that the first Aggie, I think, is the one that lives right across the street from him or somewhere really close. So I think if his age is more of that of a college age person or a teenager, we would be able to trace the fact that this Aggie is someone that he knew from his childhood, that he went to school with, or something like that. It's like the teenage crush, or, like, you know, that first person that he may have had some sort of, you know, not necessarily a romantic relationship, but there was some sort of relationship from his, you know, youth. And you can get that she's still enamored with him, but he's also, you know, then of that age where he's exploring and he's attracted to perhaps a slightly, you know, if they played the other female as maybe a couple years older than him, or, you know, somewhere around there, then I feel like that works more, because, you know, you could understand this teenager deciding about the past versus the future, the girl that's familiar with him versus the girl that's unknown and that's a little risque and stuff like that. So I think that relationship works better if he's younger. His relationship with his mom works better if he's younger, because they do some weird stuff that you, like, don't, like, there's this weird back and forth between them where he doesn't like her, but he likes her. And then they, like, there's almost like a relationship that you would expect a mom to have with somebody that's younger versus somebody that's 40. Because of a couple different sequences and how they play that, where it just comes off really weird when he's grown. And, like, I don't necessarily buy the, you know, from a teenager standpoint or from a young adult, you would get more of his, you would buy it more where he's kind of this wanderer, that he's come and gone and that he's trying to find himself and he's been all over the country or different, you know, whatever, he hasn't been home. But, like, when it's a 40-year-old, it's kind of like, is that his thing? Like, what does he do for a job? Like, it doesn't connect the dots as easily. So I feel like there's just multiple things that don't work with him being middle-aged versus, say, 19 to 22 or something.
Yeah, because there's a difference between being sympathetic and almost feeling like a leech. And, like, this is, like, he's just taking advantage of individuals. Like, when he's calling someone, like, mom and dad, like, he does that a lot. He calls everyone. And at first, I'm like, I was confused. I'm like, is he related to everybody? But it just, it's like his character thing. But when that person's like 15 years older than you, that's just weird. It's like that.
Right.
You guys are probably in the same high school. Like, what are you doing? But I did also have a question. I mentioned the accents coming up. Was that at all distracting? Because I know going into this, like, it was ridiculed at the time, especially from people of the area. Like, what did you know? Was that ever distracting, trying to just figure out, is Cary Grant giving an accent? Is he talking different? Like, I don't know how you felt about that.
I think a lot of times with, I don't know, it's something that typically doesn't fall on my radar when people have a good accent or a bad accent, especially in older stuff, because I feel like, kind of, I brought this up at one point before, I just feel like in movies from the 1930s to the 1940s, somewhere in there, I feel some people just talk differently than I'm used to hearing people talk nowadays. So I think I get lost in the fact that I'm already trying to not pay attention to the fact that they're talking in different cadences and using different languages than we use now. So I think accents, especially in this older style of film, is somewhat lost on me. I'm also not someone that has a great, I mean, I can see if something's just bad. Like, I could tell that this was inconsistent across the board. Like, I know we're supposed to be in the UK, it seems like, but at times I'm like, I don't, this may be a make-believe land that it's just like a combination of multiple things. So I can tell when it's like inconsistent, but I'm not someone that has a super great ear for, like, I couldn't tell you if it's like a, I don't know, I'm going to sound stupid right now, but like an Irish accent versus a Scottish accent.
Like, no, I get, like, are the different parts of, like, the Cagney, like, you know,
right.
All the different, you know, he doesn't, does he sound like, what's his name? Dick Van Dyke from Mary Poppins, you know, it wasn't like that, but I agree with you. Cary Grant itself, like, I don't even, like, he has a unique voice and, like, presentation and begin with, like, I can't really, he has that type of, like, accent. It almost feels like it's from another country. So I think the reason why I found it distracting, because it just, he has such a distinct voice that when it, you don't have that, or it comes and goes, it just was more noticeable compared to, like, the other characters. Like, it wasn't as, you know, that big of a deal, but it was just with him, because he has such a distinct way of talking that is just so iconic. When you then try to go a different direction, it becomes a bit more noticeable. That didn't necessarily negatively impact me a great deal. I did want to talk about at least some things I did like about the movie, and I did find it interesting, because I know, as I mentioned, like, going in looking at some research, how, like, people, there was a rally against this movie on, like, a political standpoint, because especially for those that felt like it was very communist in its approach, because it's a very much, you know, the preaching the message that the poor is taking away from the poor, as the rich class is just kind of standing above them as they fight amongst themselves. And seeing that kind of played out, I thought was actually, I'm like, oh, actually, I like the way they're approaching this. And it's kind of, it felt almost ahead of its time in some of its, the way it was going about it. I guess you could, you know, not like it's brand new. I mean, Charles Dickens did similar things, but I did find that that was very effective in the sense of showing just the way class was operating at the time, and how a lot of these people were just stuck in these roles, and they're unable to find an escape. And I guess you could say that could legitimize Cary Grant's character a bit more, because it is something that feels like a lot of people within that town are just, you know, there's nowhere to go. But I thought overall, like, that was probably my favorite part of the film.
I think it's interesting to me when it comes to times in our history, I guess it's apropos because it feels like we're going through one now, but times in our history where politics is to the extreme, what they will grasp at to latch on to whatever the agenda was. Like, so far we've watched two films over the Hitchcock and the Cary Grant retrospective that have been accused of being almost like communist propaganda or Axis propaganda with Lifeboat, and now this one. And like, I just feel like there's no part of either one of those that really fits that narrative. And it's just interesting which ones get, like, lumped in with that. Like, obviously this was like the HUAC or whatever committee that was going, doing the things they did. And you know, obviously there was a blacklist at this time in Hollywood and all that stuff. But like, I'm watching this film and I'm not like, if talking about different classes, like, different classes have existed throughout humanity. Like, there's never been a system where there hasn't been the rich and the poor. So
it's like, it's not that much different than, you know, A Christmas Carol and what Scrooge learns, regarding the, you know, how wealth can, this pursuit of wealth and what it could lead to. And then, you know, the message that Cary Grant character says about, you know, being a poor person taking away from more poor people. And it's just intriguing considering, like, this is what, 1944, so long before the Red Scare, that was, it became such a sensitive topic eventually. It was just, I don't know, it strange, but I thought it was effective in that messaging. And like I said, I think the book probably, I could see where it's probably even stronger, getting more time to get to that story.
I think, too, just along those same lines, kind of to what you were saying, I do appreciate, because during this time period, it seemed like a lot of times Hollywood was more about the escape. Like, Hollywood was more about, you know, when we're going through depression or when we're going through war. I'm not saying, like, everybody ignored it, but, like, there was a number of different films that came out during those different times that were the polar opposite, right? Like, we have, like, crazy comedies and different stuff that was, like, as far from that as you could, you know, get. And I do appreciate that there's films like this one that, on the other hand, actually delve into it. And, like, this is, like, what is actually going on. This is, like, a realistic, outside of his age being wrong, but it's, like, a realistic portrait of life in this area during this time, dealing with these real situations and real things. So I do appreciate, like, the reality of it, I guess, or the authenticity, what it came across to me, at least.
Yeah, that I think was a strong element of it too. And I think there's a lot of different pieces of this too. Like Cary Grant's character on paper, like, it's intriguing, like him having a perfect pitch, even though I guess technically reading things that he gets a few things wrong when he calls out like what note they're being played. But hey, I know nothing, so I had no idea.
Right.
But also, did you have any thoughts on like the overall supporting cast? Because I know, you know, we mentioned Cary Grant gets an Oscar nomination, but he's not the only person from the film that gets an Oscar nomination. The actress playing his mother as well, which I thought she was well-deserving, but any thoughts on that cast?
I had no exposure with Ethel Barrymore whatsoever. I've never seen anything that she's been in. Obviously, you know the family, and you know, like, there's lots of connections to lots of famous folks in Hollywood, but this was my initial exposure to her, and obviously she did a lot more stage stuff, I believe, than she did even film stuff. I think this kind of got her back into film. I think I read somewhere where she had been out of the film work and more just doing stage productions for a while, and this kind of coaxed her back out, and then she moves to California and does a bunch more films after this, I believe is what I read. But I thought she did a great job. I actually really liked the two supporting females that he's involved with. June Duprez as Ada, I think, is one of them, and Jane Wyatt as Aggie is the other. I thought Aggie, like the friend next door type, the girl next door, I guess you could call her, I thought she was phenomenal. So I wanted to see more of her, and I was like, why is this guy not just immediately like she's very clear that she like, I liked how like forthcoming she was and just not trying to play any games. She's just like, I'm in love with you, I always will be. You can go do your stupid stuff, and I'll probably still be here waiting for you. Like, it was just, I don't know. It was an honesty that I kind of enjoyed.
Yeah.
There was one that I don't necessarily think there was anything wrong with his performance. I did think that, I think as Barry Fitzgerald as Henry Twitt, I can't remember how they pronounced it in the movie. He was the guy that like somehow becomes his buddy in this film, and then they're like, all of a sudden, is that the guy that they all of a sudden are drinking together, and then they're like doing all these things? And I never quite understood that like connection, that relationship, or the interaction between those two. I don't know if I was just being ignorant to what the story was telling me, or if it had something to do with his age. I don't know. I didn't understand that relationship and that like connection at all. Like, he runs into him in the church in the beginning. They clearly don't know each other.
Yeah.
Then he runs into him again. Then all of a sudden they're like, he's this guy's best friend. Like, he's going to do everything for him. He's going to try to help him with this girl. He's going to try to help him with his crime troubles. Like, all of a sudden they're like connected at the hip, and I really didn't quite understand it. But I mean, that one was a little bit weird to me. And then, of course, the guy that plays like the head of the gangster group.
Yeah.
The Mordenoy guy. Like, I thought he played his role fine, but I was more so connected, I believe, to the different females that played some of the supporting cast. I thought they did a good job. What about you?
Yeah, the only one, Jim Mulderoy, his character, I felt like he needed to be a bit more like menacing. Like, he's supposed to be this major threat, this guy that's supposed to like instill fear in that neighborhood. And also, you know, have kind of a debonair type of attitude as well. And I never got that from him. He
right.
You know, when he's like commanding people in this pawn shop and like telling them to act a certain way and like, and Cary Grant's like reluctance to step in. It also doesn't help that like Cary Grant's such an opposing physical figure. It's like so much taller than everybody. It's like, I don't know. It doesn't feel, that's again, another example of just like the casting not working. Cause he's like,
well, and the age difference, you get that. Yeah. It'd be much different if he's attracted to like this girl that's a mystery, but then the girl is not married to somebody that was older than he yeah. is and more imposing, and Cary Grant's a teenager, that plays a whole different way. Then now it's like, yeah. you're both about the same age. Cary Grant's easily bigger than you, and you're not very intimidating. It just doesn't work on any level.
Yeah. And again, that's the thing, like on paper, like I get where this, like what they're doing here, but just the execution wasn't there, because it just wasn't a very believable scene. So that was my only, like, maybe, like, again, if you had a teenager playing that role, it would make more sense, within that dynamic, I felt like so much of the movie hinges upon it, and I found it a little weak. I do agree, like, the performances from June Dupree and Jane Wyatt, like, they were really strong, and like you mentioned with the one character, like, even she feels very modern in her approach, like, her, like, kind of, de facto, just going to the truth, like, this is it, this is how it is. That was rather refreshing. So
right.
So, but yeah.
Yeah, I the other thing I was curious about what your take was, obviously Ethel Barrymore's character and Cary Grant's character, you know, the mom and the son, that we have this dynamic that he's against inheriting the family business, right? Like, she has this business of, I don't know exactly what it is, some sort of reselling, you know, retail reselling of sorts. And it seems like he has wants nothing to do with it, which I don't know if they explore that quite enough. But then we also have the idea that, you know, these other folks come in there and try to get her to sell like stolen goods, and she doesn't want to do it. And then she gets accused of it. She gets arrested. There's all this other stuff, you know, obviously she's sick the whole time with cancer, you know, and all of these types of things. What did you think about the dynamic of like where she worked, where he didn't want to work, and then these other folks coming in with the crime angle that gets inserted into this story?
Yeah, again, I think, like, I get where she was coming from in the sense of, you know, she's a mom, she wants to protect her kid, and she's like, this is the only way. And in the sense of how they showed the limited options that these people had, like, you know, either they're going to keep coming, there's nothing you can do, but also looking at the world, they're getting cheated as well. So does it make sense? Like, is this a way for her to, you know, it's even if she's hurt in the long run, help out her son? Again, it probably makes more sense if the son isn't a little, not to beat a dead horse. But I thought in the sense of how it impacts like her relationship with the son, maybe not as strong, but general how it kind of showcases just the way in which these people were kind of, had lack of support. There was nothing there for them. So the police weren't going to help them. She couldn't really do anything. So it was either, do I do this or do I not? And so I thought that approach with her character, like, I felt her dilemma was much more compelling than Cary Grant's.
Yeah. I did want to mention too, Jane Wyatt. I remember when we were watching this, Amanda and myself, we looked up a couple of things while we were watching it. And I was interested to see that Jane Wyatt played Spock's mom in Star Trek, the original series, and in the 1986 film, The Voyage Home. She's plays Spock's mom. And she was also the mom on the Father Knows Best series as well. So she had quite the career after this as well. Nice. So not a surprise, because she was definitely, like I said, a presence on the screen. So obviously, I think we're both kind of somewhat in the same camp as far as, like, I think there was... You hear this a lot from movie critics, I guess, and I'm not calling myself a movie critic, but you hear this a lot where they say, like, there's a good film in here somewhere.
Yeah.
It just didn't come together in the way that you would hope it could. And I think, like you said, it starts with the casting of Cary Grant. This age difference really throws off a whole lot of relationships, not just between him and the mom, but between him and the two girls, between him and the Jim Mordenoy. I think it just throws all of those things off. But when you, like, get away from some of that and you kind of get down to the nuts and bolts of what they're actually feeling with the class situation, with the, you know, the poor man's plight and things of that nature. When you see him like walking the streets, I screwed up because I was, it said on the streaming service that I was using this, that there was a trailer, which threw me off at first. And, you know, my wife wanted to know if she wanted to watch it with me or not. And I'm like, well, I'll just play this trailer. I don't even think trailers existed in 1940, whatever. So oh, no, the trailer, did. Oh, did they? Okay. Well, yeah. The trailer, when you hit the trailer for this, it literally just plays the first like 5 minutes of the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's literally just him walking into that church in the tomb of the unknown soldier or whatever the official, that's not what it's called because it's in the UK, but whatever that is. And then he's walking down the streets and he's kind of by himself and stuff like that. That's what played when I hit play the trailer. And, but I think that does highlight those first 5 minutes. That does highlight, I feel like for me, what some of the strengths are when there's those quiet moments of him like reflecting or him just trying to take in where he is in the world and kind of where his place is. I think that's where this movie could have really like been great if all the other pieces had also lined up with that. So I don't know. I feel like it could have been a good movie. I feel like it could be remade into a good movie. I just feel like with what we got, it just didn't quite all add up for me.
Yeah. How did you, like, we haven't really talked about it directly outside of the accent, but just overall, beyond the casting piece, like Cary Grant's performance, you know, this is the second, the only time outside of Penny Serenade where he's nominated for an Oscar. Did you feel watching this like, okay, this is what I think of when I think of an Oscar performance? Or do you think it was more of a situation where here's a comedic actor doing something a bit more serious? So maybe that they kind of gave him, I can't really compare it to the other films of that time. So maybe he was deserving, but I'm not saying he wasn't. I'm just curious if you felt like this was, watching this was a performance you would expect to see nominated for the Oscar.
I think where he's at fault more is, like I said before, is the fact that he wasn't able to separate himself enough in the like when he like read the story or when he became interested in it to like realize that he wasn't the right person. Like, I think that's where he's at fault. When it comes to the actual movie and the performance, I don't think he did anything wrong. Like, I think he's acting well. I think his charisma adds to the fact that you have two different girls that are interested in him. Obviously, he plays that well. I feel like he did a good job in his performance. Maybe the accent you could hold against him a little bit, but I feel like the performance was fine. But I don't think, I guess this is proof because he's Cary Grant. Like, even Cary Grant and doing what he could do wasn't going to make this work when the age was so wrong, right? Like,
yeah.
I think he made it work as well as anybody was going to be able to make it work. So I don't think it's any fault of his actual performance, acting, you know, line delivery, his physical acting. Like, I think all of that was what it needed to be. I think the problems were more outside of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, as you mentioned, when you have those moments, like, I think what's really strong about the performance is that he does remove those elements that he's known for. And it's not very showy. Like, the Penny Serenade, you have that scene where he's protecting his daughter and he goes on this, you know, huge diatribe regarding trying to save us, in that's that Oscar moment. And I don't think we get as many of those, but kind of in a good way. Like, if I'm just like looking at the performance of these scenes isolated, I think he shows like he can be that actor and he can do it without having to, you know, in a silent manner. Like you mentioned, there's a lot of scenes where he's just walking and you can see the life he lived on his face, and thought that was really effective. And you could probably tell, like you mentioned, like you connected to this material and you see that in the way the weight he's carrying. But at sometimes, like, what the words he's saying and the situation he's in sometimes don't always line up.
And I feel like this is also like almost like something that I know he connected to the story and he connected to all of those elements. But I think also there may have been a tiny bit of him that was still, I know it lists Arsenic and Old Lace and None But the Lonely Heart both coming out in 1944. As we talked about when we talked about Arsenic and Old Lace, they had actually filmed that, you know, years before. So he probably did a couple things in between these two, if I was like wanting to do the research and find out when the actual filming happened of each of his movies. But I can't help but think of also like he really wanted to be doing something like this after that. And that's not saying anything bad about Arsenic and Old Lace. We just know that he felt like it was too much and he was over the top too much and things of that nature. So I'm wondering if this was almost like for him okay, this is getting me back to my roots. This is more of what I want to be like known for, as something more serious and dramatic. I don't know. I know he said that in when he got his honorary Academy Award, I think in 1970 or 77, I think it was 1970, he said that this was the only, or somebody said that this was the only film that he like requested for sure to be in the montage of his films that played. Like, he's like, I don't care, you know, basically what other scenes you put in here from all my other movies, but I want something from None But The Lonely Heart in this montage. So it is something that this may have been something that he was really wanting to do after Arsenic and Old Lace, just because it may have been for him more of that serious, down-to-earth type of film that he wanted to be known for. And, you know, obviously maybe that's why he requested this to be the in his montage for that Oscar Academy Award perform, like the honorary award that he got in the 1970s. So it's interesting, like when you look at the filmography and see this one coming after Arsenic and Old Lace, I don't know if that played into any of it or not.
Yeah, and speaking of the Oscars, like looking at like who he competed with Best Actor, was actually one was his co-star in this film, Barry Fitzgerald, who was got nominated for Going My Way, along with Bing Crosby, who got nominated, actually ended up winning for Going My Way, which won Best Picture that year, and then Charles Boyer for Gaslight, and then Alexander Knox for Wilson, and I realize I've seen none of those films except for this one. So I've heard like Going My Way is like one of the worst films that's ever won Best Picture. I don't know how true that is. I've heard very like, you know, mixed things. But
I did read that he was the only one that got nominated for the Best Actor in that group. All the other ones that were Best Actor were from a movie that got nominated for Best Picture, and and this did not. This just got Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress, Best Film Editing, and Best Scoring of a Dramatic or Comedy Picture. And Ethel Barrymore did win for the Supporting Actress, which is interesting.
Which is interesting, too. I just saw this, but Barry Fitzgerald got nominated for both leading and supporting for the same role, which is kind of crazy. So I guess
no wonder we can never figure it out.
They, I guess they changed their roles after that, so they can't do that anymore. But that's hilarious, because
get all the awards.
You're both a supporting performance and a lead performance, but yeah.
You supported yourself, I guess.
But yeah. Anything else you wanted to talk about regarding this?
No, I mean, I think it was interesting to see him in more of a literally hardly any comedy involved here, you know, nothing that's over the top. So it was interesting to see this, and I'm glad we watched this along with Penny Serenade to like see the two different roles that he got nominated for. I definitely think it's like a different pace, and I appreciate them for different reasons. I understand why he's not known necessarily for these two roles over some of the other ones we've seen. Like, obviously, you're going to hear more about Bringing Up Baby or His Girl Friday or Arsenic and Old Lace or the Hitchcock films. I get why those are the ones that more people talk about, but I do think that it's worth seeing these two just to see this other side of him.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's not one where, I know you mentioned like the how it's shown within his honorary Academy Award, but it's not like there's not a lot of like, highlights in this, like where it's like these are these showy moments and things like that, and which I think was good. Like, it made me respect him more as an actor because it shows that he is much more dynamic than maybe people give him credit for. He can kind of do it all. He can, even if maybe not all, because like you said, doesn't necessarily always work with this role, but he has range. So that, you know, he's the type of actor that can kind of get claimed. All he does is the same role. And I don't necessarily think that is a byproduct of talent, more so a byproduct of the way casting works, especially at that time where they're going to put you where they think you should be put. So it was kind of good that he got the chance to say, like, no, I'm going to do my own thing. Even if it didn't completely work, I think I'm still, like you said, I'm glad I watched it. Not a movie I'd recommend that you have to, like, seek out, per se, unless you're a really big Cary Grant fan. But,
If you were making like a list of the essential Cary Grant, that like if somebody really wanted to like know all about him, like which films you would suggest, I don't think this would make the cut.
No, yeah, I think I would say Penny Serenade more so than this one for sure.
Well, all right, so that does it for None But The Lonely Heart. We're going to actually jump way into the future for our next one. I know that a lot of these other ones we've kind of been going year by year, like His Girl Friday was 1940, The Philadelphia Story was 1940. Penny Serenade was 41. Arsenic and Old Lace and None But the Lonely Heart both technically listed as 44. But now we're jumping all the way to 1957. So we're going to go 13 years into the future for a film entitled An Affair to Remember. This is listed as a romance film starring Cary Grant and Deborah Kerr. Do you know anything about An Affair to Remember, Dan?
I don't. I've never watched it. It's one of those movies, like, I've heard the title plenty of times, but I've never seen it. I don't know much about the story, so it'll be similar to this in the sense of going in very blind.
Yeah, I will be going in blind as well. In between here, just so you know why there's such a gap in us going from 1944 to 1957, he did make quite a number of films like in that interim, but a couple of them were for Hitchcock. So this is when Notorious comes out. This is when To Catch a Thief comes out. And then there is probably about, you know, eight or nine other movies as well that we're not covering for this retrospective. But we have two left. We have An Affair to Remember in 1957, and then we'll go to 1963 for Charade, which is one of his last film roles. So I have not seen or know anything about either one, so I'm interested to see how we kind of end this with these two, or if we decide to throw any extra bonus ones in there, we'll have to decide that and let you all know. So Dan, how can people keep in touch with you, or if they have a message or a question for you, how can they send it to you?
Just search Comic Concierge on pretty much all social media platforms, and you can find me there.
All right. You can search me out at Optimus Solo, or you can search the show with the Cinema Geeks, or you can go to geekcastradio.com and find some other geeky content, video games, cartoons, comics, etc., if you're into any of that. So that does it for this episode. Tune in next time for another chance to listen to more of the Cinema Geeks.